The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Good morning, everybody. It's good to see you here. Good to see you here, my beloved white community. And I know some of you have seen me before, and I do use some of the same stories, and I can't remember like if I use this story here before or not. And so if you've heard this story, I hope you'll be patient with me. So I, in my 20s, fell in love with a black man. We got married, we had children, and my children were and continue to be very good teachers about lots of things, including race. And so when my oldest son, Kadeen, was about 5, he was very interested in everything having to do with firefighters. And my son was into firefighters, and we had an Ebony magazine. Ebony is a black magazine, and every issue there was like the Eligible Bachelor. And this one happened to be in his firefighter outfit. And so my son wanted me to read him the description of this Eligible Bachelor. And so it was saying things about him, like his interests, like he liked, you know, cars, or he liked football, or whatever his interests were. And then it said he was looking for a woman who was active in the black community. And my son said to me, well, what's the black community? And I tried to explain what that meant. And then he said, well, am I in the black community? And I said, yes, you're part of the black community. And he said, are you in the black community? I said, no, I'm not. He said, well, why not? And I tried to tell him, well, it's because I'm white, I'm not black. And he said then, are you a member of the white community? Well, he probably didn't say member. Are you part of the white community? I said, yeah, I guess I probably am, although I don't think about it that way. And probably none of us who identify as white grew up thinking of ourselves as part of a white community. And this is part of the socialization in our country around race. And really around lots of different things that we think about ourselves as individuals. We don't tend to think about ourselves as members of a racial community, although maybe that's shifting. And I think it's important for us to cultivate our sense of community with other white people around being anti-racist. Whatever that's going to look like in your life. And I'm not assuming something about what that looks like. But part of my intention here today is to help us cultivate our community where we're looking at and talking about racial issues as they relate to ourselves and our practices. And I think it's really important, this, you know, wonderful gift we have of our practices that can support us in the sometimes difficult work of looking at ourselves in relationship to race. So I appreciate your willingness to come together and be part of community around this issue and in the context of your practice. So I've given you a handout that has a certain amount of what I'm going to say. I have some other things I'll add to it, but I thought that it would help you in a way to have something to anchor you and take home with you about this conversation we're having. And although I'm not going to spend very much time on it, I do just want to name at the beginning here that this conversation that we'll have, this listening and talking that we're going to be doing together, is part of our practice, and we can be supported in it by remembering, you know, some of the other teachings that we may have been exposed to. And here I've just done some naming about six traditional activities in which we train to help us awaken our hearts and minds. And this naming comes from Pema Chodron. She talks about generosity, discipline, patience, joyful exertion, meditation, and prajna, or unconditional wisdom. So as we're here today, and I'm not going to go into great detail about each of these, but just knowing what we know about patience and generosity, I'm inviting all of us to bring those kinds of qualities to ourselves and to each other as we're here together in community. Our aspirations to be better human beings may inadvertently hinder us. To be good people, we tend to bypass the messiness of our lives in order to enter the gate of tranquility. And this quote comes from Zenju Earthlin Manuel in her book, The Way of Tenderness. And I think this is a really helpful naming, because my assumption is that all of us have this intention, a good intention, to be like a conscious, good white person. And that helps guide us in terms of having an intention, and it also can become problematic when we start to organize our identities around being good and wanting to look good and feel good, and that can get in the way of actually working with the complexity or the messiness of our lives. And so this morning I'm inviting us to open the door a little bit into some of that messiness. I think that's where there's actually kind of juiciness to learn from and to deepen our practice. As unconscious, habits of white privilege do not merely go unnoticed. They actively thwart the process of conscious reflection on them, which allows them to seem non-existent even as they continue to function. And this comes from Sullivan in her book, Revealing Whiteness. And I think this is one of the places our practice can help us. So how do we, if things are unconscious, you know, how do we even get at that? So it takes a lot of cultivating of our conscious awareness, a lot of sitting with our own minds, and then carrying that into our everyday lives to begin to notice some of what just, you know, we couldn't even see. I know I did my dissertation on the topic of whiteness, and so I had at that time been paying attention to race for a while. But even with that, when I was interviewing white women who either had been or were in relationships with black men, and I got my, you know, transcript, my first transcripts from interviews, and I'm reading them, and like, it was hard for me to see anything about whiteness. Like it's like I couldn't see it. It was so taken for granted. And I remember, you know, one of the things that helped me begin to see more was when people would say things that seemed contradictory, which actually happens quite a lot when we talk about race. And so this white woman, I started out, initially when I was doing interviews, I started out by asking, so, you know, how do you think about yourself as a white woman? And she said, well, I'm not white. And I thought, oh, now what do I do? You know, like I wasn't, you know, what's my follow-up question? My whole, you know, interview is about whiteness. And so, you know, that was, I found a way to keep going, and she told me how she wasn't white. But then later in the interview, she was talking about sitting out on her step in her neighborhood, and as the only white person on the street, having some feelings about that. And I thought, oh, so now she is white. And so, you know, this is interesting to me. And that helped me begin to see something about, you know, she wasn't conscious about this. And I think there's many things we aren't conscious of about ourselves, not just about race, but noticing those kind of contradictions or discrepancies is a little clue, like there's an entry place in. And I think other people's stories are also helpful to us in this way, that like it even if it's not exactly our experience, it helps to kind of stir things up and help us bring more awareness. So some of what I'm going to be sharing today will apply to you and some of it won't, but I'm hoping to have little seeds that, you know, plant in your awareness and may help you see something in your life after this morning. And the other thing I just want to say about, I'm drawing a lot today from the work of Robin DiAngelo, and I have acknowledged her on the handouts, but you know, what I'm saying is very informed by several different things she's written. And so I just want to give credit to her and also say I personally am still grappling with these ideas that I'm going to be talking about. Like, I don't have it all together and all figured out. And I don't know if I agree with everything that she has to say or not. You know, I'm still letting it percolate inside. I'm still learning about it. So I want you to know I don't have like this all figured out. And I also wanted to give acknowledgement to her for her ideas and how they're very stimulating to me. And part of why I wanted to come do this today is I want other people to talk with about these ideas to help me in my own learning and my own practice. So I know some of you at Common Ground have been meeting together and talking about the white racial frame. I just would like to get a sense, how many of you have been part of those conversations? Okay, so the majority of us haven't been, so that's just good for me to know. So talking a little bit about whiteness. Whiteness, there are different ways we could talk about it, and I think this naming from Ruth Frankenberg is helpful to think about whiteness as a location of structural advantage or privilege. So this means things come to us, advantages come to us, privileges come to us just because of being perceived to be in the white category. Whiteness also being a standpoint, a place from which white people look at ourselves, at others, and at society. So it's a kind of positioning that shapes our seeing, what we see and how we see. And then a set of cultural practices that are usually unmarked and unnamed, meaning makes it hard to see if we don't have language or awareness about them. And so these cultural practices sometimes seem empty because they just seem normal. It's just the way things are. And they also can seem just American for those of us who are positioned in other categories of privilege in terms of social class, in terms of sexual orientation. Like if we're in the middle, we just feel like normal. That's what normal is. To be in the dominant categories that are unmarked. And these cultural practices can also be full because they create these norms, these ideas of what's normal or just the typical way of being. And they create ways of thinking about the world, ourselves and others that impact all of us. And this naming about whiteness is very similar to the white racial frame. And I wanted to just include that for people who have been talking about it, a kind of worldview. And it includes ideas about how we can even think and talk about race. And also images, emotions, interpretations. There's a whole bundle that goes with the white racial frame. And I want to focus in on three aspects of whiteness that I think are really important in shaping us, and those are colorblindness, individualism, and binary or either-or thinking. And in the white worldview, colorblindness is this idea that it's, I think it comes out of a really well-intentioned place, like we're all together here on the planet. We have our common humanity, and we value equality and fairness. And out of those ideals came a practice of saying, well, since that's what we value, the good and right thing to do is to not notice race, to not talk about race, and to even notice or talk about it might be discriminating. So the other thing that comes from that is to, it's not that people would claim, well, I don't literally see your race, because it registers in our brains someone's physical characteristics, and we've been socialized to categorize based on things like skin color and hair. And so we see something about the category that someone might belong in, but colorblindness would say, well, those differences aren't meaningful. It doesn't matter what category you're in. And it's true that we are all together here on the planet. We have our common humanity. But I think it matters a lot what racial category we're in, because it shapes how we're positioned in terms of advantage and disadvantage. And it shapes the way that we've been socialized to look at ourselves and other people. And for people who aren't white, it shapes a lot about their realities that we may not be aware of because we don't experience it. I remember I grew up in Wisconsin out in the country, and when I first took my African-American partner out to the country with me, and we went, we were walking out in the countryside, and I grew up where it was just normal to, when you come to a barbed wire fence, you just crawl under it or go through it. And, we got to a fence, and he said, there's no way I'm going past that fence. Like, that fence, that's somebody's property, and you get in trouble if you go on other people's property. And he had a whole different set of socialization around respecting limits and boundaries, because he had to in order to be safe in the world. And I think about this often when I'm walking. Like, sometimes when I'm walking in my neighborhood, I live over in Uptown, and I like to go to the little free libraries, and I know where they all are. And so I take this kind of meandering route through the neighborhood if I'm on an errand. And I just think, if one of my sons was doing this, I don't think they would go unnoticed. You know, I can just do this. I can walk and not think about it. It's not that I think I shouldn't be able to do that, and this is where privilege gets tricky, is privilege is really, in many ways a human right to be able to just walk in the neighborhood and not be suspect, not be under suspicion. But if we haven't heard about the experiences of other people, like, this was eye-opening to me when Richard said, no, I'm not going through that fence. And just to begin to learn about what his reality had been that would make him, even though there's, like, we haven't run into anybody on the walk, like, there's nobody around and there's not going to be anybody around, but he was really clear he's not going to cross that line, that would make him feel unsafe in the world. That was all news to me. I was used to just walking really wherever I wanted without thinking too much about it. I was pretty naive. And even when I came to the city, I was, my naivete led me to walk places that probably other people maybe would have been more cautious. So to start to see how race is meaningful in creating our identities, our ways of looking at the world, and that other people, it's meaningful to them. And to say, I don't notice race is actually considered to be a microaggression, a way that you don't get something important about the reality for a person of color who all the time is having experiences of disadvantage or devaluation based on being perceived in a racial category. And individualism, I've already mentioned, makes us not see the whole social and cultural context that has contributed to these racial dynamics. It focuses on just, I'm a unique individual. And although each of us might be a unique individual, we aren't just a unique individual. We're also shaped by our racial socialization. And so when we think about ourselves as just individuals, we miss a lot in terms of the dynamics that are shaping us and other people. And the other thing that happens with individualism is racism gets talked about then as this kind of interpersonal, mean-spirited or prejudiced way of speaking or behaving. So everything about race gets condensed to this individual level way of looking at the world. And it's true that any person could be mean or could be prejudiced about people in other groups. And that's not the same thing, though, as a whole system of racism and a whole history of white supremacy. And so this leads into this binary thinking that is very common, that thinks about, well, racist is, you know, somebody who's probably, and we have stereotypes about this, from the South and old, and they are mean-spirited, and they intend to do harm, and they're like a bad person. And then in our either-or thinking, we go to, and then there's like the conscious good person who might be younger and from the North in our stereotypes and well-intentioned and doesn't mean to do any harm. And so now, you know, most of us, what we want to do, of course, in this either-or way of thinking, we want to be here, the good, conscious, white person. And if we position ourselves here in this individualistic either-or way of thinking, now we could say, well, I'm off the hook. There's nothing for me to look at about myself because I'm one of the good ones. And so this gets in the way of us actually seeing more about how we have been shaped by racial socialization. So to unsettle our either-or thinking, I think, is really important, and to hold the complexity of I can be a good person and I have things to look at, ways that I might be unconscious, ways that I do harm that I certainly don't intend, and yet it seems like that's the impact I've had. So to unsettle those practices in and of itself, I think that's an important step, to start to notice how we're under the influence of those ways of being in the world. So, do you have any questions at this point about what I've said? Yes. Yeah, well, I would say it would be different. Like, I want to do the both and kind of answer. So the way we do race, we do have a Minnesota flavor, or you could even say a Twin Cities flavor, because I think it's different if you're away from the Twin Cities. And there are ways that our flavor here, like when people talk about Minnesota nice, you know, we have a certain flavor of how we relate. And of course, I'm stereotyping. It doesn't apply exactly in the same way to every person. And yet, there are patterns on that local level. There are patterns on the national level. And there are patterns on the global level. So, for example, whiteness is highly valued around the world. People around the world to this day soak in water with bleach to try and look whiter because there are privileges or advantages to being perceived as lighter skinned. So that pattern happens around the world. But how we do race is different in different locations because of history and context. So how it's done in Canada is influenced by the United States, because here they are in the shadow of us as this dominant country. They're influenced, but they also have their own history and their own ways of doing things and even different language. And so they would call, you know, what we would call Indians or Native Americans, they would call First Nations people. And of course, the history in Germany is shaped by the Holocaust that happened there. And so every place has its particular history that shapes how people do race. And I know when I talked here before, I talked about my socialization as a good white girl. And actually, it was really useful to me because I learned silence. That was part of my learning, you know, and harmony. And you know, somebody here from the East Coast said that was not how you are a good white girl. Where I grew up, like there at my dinner table, you debate and you show your knowledge and your ability to engage with political and social issues and be well-read and well-spoken. Well, that was a different version. But we had some commonality about wanting to be perceived as good. And at that point in our socialization, not thinking about our race at all. You know, like maybe thinking about our gender, not thinking about race. That we had in common, despite the differences in how we were socialized about what good meant. So same and different. Yeah, well, I appreciate you doing this naming because it's true. Like when I'm cooking dinner with my sons, are we thinking about race? Not necessarily. We're thinking about our different cooking styles, and some of us are messy and some of us clean as we go. And, you know, so we aren't thinking about race, but we do regularly talk about race. And so again, I think it's a both and. And what I would say, I because I teach, I get to hear stories from a lot of young people who think their generation is beyond all of this. And so they haven't, you know, they might have friends of color, my white students, but they haven't talked to them about race. And I give them an assignment to go and talk about race with someone. And they start to talk. And they actually find out that their friends of color appreciate them bringing it up and having some awareness. And I know my own sons with their white friends, you know, these are dear, beloved friends. And my son, in particular right now, as he's gotten older, he's deeply disappointed that his white friends are not attuned to racial realities, not that interested, seemingly. And it's, he's questioning his friendships because of their lack of attention to something that matters to him a lot. And I have dear friends of color who, you know, it's like with my sons, we're not all the time thinking about race and our racial differences. And my own experience is, yes, we can love deeply and connect across races. You know, that's absolutely possible to do. So it's not a barrier. It's not an inherent or innate barrier to be able to connect with someone across racial differences and love deeply. At the same time, I think my part of, you know, what makes us friends is they appreciate my interest in race, and we talk quite a bit about it. Now, not everybody's that interested. But I think to be able to talk about it is an important thing in friendships. And even though it's not, you know, it's not what you're talking about all the time, it's not what's in the foreground all the time. And it's just like any of our identities. Like, we have multiple aspects of identity. So which identity is in the foreground shifts in different situations and different relationships. So, you know, it's like what I think is important, and this goes back to what I said earlier about, you know, our practice. So if we haven't paid much attention to race, in terms of having some discipline around our practice, it might help us to up the kind of attention we pay. And it can feel awkward at first and like a barrier. And how do I navigate this if I have friends where I haven't talked about it in the past? If we talked about it all the time and focused on only that, then we might say, you know, it's got its grip on us and we're under the influence, and a little more space and attention to other things could be useful. So how we practice, I think, depends on how we are in relationship to it to begin with. But I would suggest experimenting with your friends and see what happens. Like, say, you know, people in my circles have been talking more about race, and I've started to think about it a little bit more, and, you know, here's what I've been thinking, and I just wanted to open the door to talk to you about it. Just see what happens. Yes. Yeah, well, I think... Yeah. So I totally get it that you don't want there to be differences in your friendship with this Chicano man. And I guess what I would say is our challenge is to create relational spaces that are big enough for our sameness and our difference. So if you think about any relationship you have, like you have differences with other people. And if you're going to get along over time and both feel satisfied in the relationship, probably you're going to have to learn how to accommodate each other's differences. Some people just, you know, live parallel lives and don't feel very connected, and that's how they handle their differences. But if you're going to feel connected, I think then you have to know how to make space for differences. And so our culture, one way to think about it is that when we have a ranking of differences, which we do in this culture, there's, you know, historical and current privileging certain categories being dominant, well, that creates a culture of disconnection. And so there are these obstacles to connecting across difference. And yet, this is what we all want. We all want to connect. Like, we have this longing to connect with other people and to not be afraid of other people and to be together in community. Community that's alive and dynamic and interesting because it has richness and difference in it. But the thing is, how do you connect? And there will be disconnections, and then how do you reconnect after a disconnection? So I would, you know, like, you can take baby steps to experiment with trying something new, and you risk maybe this will be a disconnection. But often, I think those little risks lead to deeper connection. Like you've just described how the fact that you've risked in the last couple of years opening the door to talking more about this difference, and your friendship has deepened. So I think that's the possibility, and there are risks. So how do you be patient with yourself, and also... this is the thing about the discipline, because it's easy if we're white in many ways just to not deal with this. Like, you wouldn't have to risk talking about differences. You wouldn't even have to risk having friends who are outside of your group. So to take the risk, and that's about the discipline of doing something different rather than the kind of... obliviousness that can go with having privilege and not having to notice or pay attention. So I appreciate your example of how you have been taking risks and deepening your connection. So, yes. Well, I'm not really in a position to know how to answer your question about whether whiteness is totally dominant around the world or whether there are cultures that some other category is dominant. I know a little bit, but not a lot. So one thing I could say is if you go, I think, to Japan, the people who are dominant there are not white people. So the Japanese, and I think that there's some history of Japanese feeling superior to other groups, and in particular histories the Japanese have with like the Koreans who are in their country and who are a minority group there. So in different countries, how we do this ranking or stratification plays out differently. And I know I've had some Chinese students who here in the United States, and they're learning about privilege, and it's eye-opening to them because when they were in China, they had privilege and were dominant and had no awareness of it, and now they come here to the United States, they don't have privilege. They're perceived as a person of color lacking in privilege, and it's, you know, unsettling. But I don't really know enough about all the places in the world how race is done to know, you know, to thoroughly answer your question. So how it's done, I think, varies. But do we rank and stratify? I think that happens around the world. So the story is about Asian countries and there's still being bleach in use and having had vivid up-close experience with that. So one of the things I wanted to do today was talk about white silence. And so I'm now moving to a page that says white silence at the top. And I'm going to be inviting you in a couple of minutes to be in groups talking about this. And this comes from Robin DiAngelo. She says, white racial comfort and sense of racial equilibrium are rooted in norms and traditions that uphold relations of inequality. One of these norms is to avoid talking openly about race, especially in mixed race groups. And she goes on to talk about how this is a key way that whiteness gets reproduced is through white silence. And white silence plays out in different ways depending upon who's involved. So is it a racially diverse group? Is it an all-white group? Is it, you know, one white person to another? Is it a white person with a person of color? There can be different dynamics. But the invitation is to look more at our silence around race. And she starts from the assumption that white silence shelters white people by keeping their, our, racial perspectives hidden and thus protected from exploration, challenge, or expansion. And there can be good reasons to be silent. So listening is a good way to learn. And I recommend it when you're in a situation that's new to you. I think that's has humility in it, and rather than, you know, going in assuming you know what's going on, to speak up. But what she says is that if listening is our only way to engage around race, now we have limited ourselves, and there are maybe unintended negative consequences to our just listening. And so she invites us to think kind of strategically about our listening and our speaking and what will be beneficial in the particular circumstance that we're in order to disrupt whiteness as usual. And she has a number of different kind of rationales that she identifies as common among white people, reasons why we might feel like I'm not going to speak up about something. And I actually have a whole bunch of material I thought I would have presented in the last half an hour about each of these. Some of them, I think, you know, kind of stand on their own without a lot of elaboration, even though each of them have more that could be said about them. But what I want to spend time on here in the next half an hour, rather than me telling you that elaboration about each of these, I'd like to spend time in small groups giving you an opportunity to speak and listen about what gets stirred up for you when you read the list here of these rationales for white silence, and maybe one of them in particular resonates with you, and maybe you have an example of a time where you didn't speak, or maybe you're going to share a time where you did speak and you talk about how that went when you spoke up. So I don't want to prescribe what you're going to talk about, but I do want you to have an opportunity to talk, and then we'll have some time as a bigger group to, you know, hear some of what you talked about and perhaps have me elaborate more on some of these. And for this activity, I was thinking about having us count off. And how many people do we have? We have 25. So let's count off by 6. And start, can we start with you? Mm-hmm. Great. So just for the sake of efficiency, let's start with the ones over in this corner, and the sixes will end up on this side, and kind of in between you can find your folks. And yes, Judy?
Mm-hmm.
I think you could think about it either way. So however it fits for you. And if you run out of steam talking about silence and speaking, you could talk about something else related to race that's on your mind. So it's really a time for you to get to talk with other folks and practice listening and speaking around race. So we'll have about a half an hour, and then I'm thinking we'll take a brief break at that point. So I'll let you know when a half an hour is up.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.